Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
An Erio's original.
But then after I kind of really nailed the characters, I asked myself a really interesting question. And that was, okay, well, now that you know who these guys are, what do you want to do?
It's taking over my dreams, waking me out of my sleep. I think I'm coming apart.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho. You're listening to The Margaret Cho. Today, we have an incredible guest. It is the Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, I'm coming out of the dark.
Oh. I'm so excited you're here.
I'm so excited to be here in palatial Margaret Cho Estates.
Well, you know, I don't think you've been here before, because you used to come and visit me in Beechwood Canyon. That was...
I actually had somebody come up to me who thought I live there because I used to visit you so much.
Oh, yeah. All right? Yeah.
They saw me leaving the place. So you live up on Beach? No, no, that's a friend of mine.
I forever associate us watching movies in my... living room that was sort of a dining room.
I can see that living room right now.
Yes. Then when I was watching Django, I remembered some things. I remember that we had watched, what was the one? Was it Mandingo with Perry King?
Yeah. Mandingo, yeah.
We watched it twice.
Yeah, right.
Like we got to the end and then we watched it in the beginning.
Yeah, the movie was real contraband. Right? You really responded to it.
It was incredible. And then, but every once in a while, like if I'm watching your movies, I will recognize something or recognize a feeling. And for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I guess we think about like actors like that were around in that era. And I was trying to think of like, who were you thinking of? Like, I don't know why, but
you
I was
mean, like for Rick Dalton?
Yeah.
He represents a whole plethora of actors that were in particularly in 1969 kind of being washed over by the zeitgeist wave.
Yes. Yes.
All right. In a way that they never would have had, you know, they never would have had it even under any understanding of it, even 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is they were all actors. This group in particular were actors that had some sort of a success on television.
Yes.
In the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And became genuine TV stars. I mean, big name stars. And then when their shows ended, either they plugged them, I'm going to own this TV thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they plugged themselves into a bunch of TV movies or plugged themselves into another series. Or they like, F this TV business. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to make movies.
Yeah.
And and some of them pulled that off. Steve McQueen, James Garner, Clint Eastwood. Those guys kind of pulled it off, but a lot of them didn't. But they had their time.
Yes,
they had their time. And so he kind of fits into the group of actors that tried to pull that off and didn't quite pull it off. And that would be people like George Maharis, mm-hmm, from Route 66,
mm-hmm,
Ed Burns.
Mm-hmm.
All right, with 77 Sunset Strip, Clint Walker to some degree,
yeah,
you know, with the show Cheyenne, Ty Harden with the show Bronco. They all had their time.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about it, though, was they were taught to be strong, masculine he-men.
Mm-hmm.
That was their thing. I mean, they literally spent their entire careers up until this point running pocket combs through their pompadours.
Right, right.
And the idea of not wearing a pompadour was just, what the fuck are you talking about? How is a man supposed to wear his hair?
Yeah, all right? Exactly.
All right. And so, and they were also, because they learned their lessons from television really, really well, they were all taught that they had to be likable.
Mm-hmm.
That was an important thing, especially for television. Like, well, why the hell would anybody lift you into their living room?
Yes.
Unless we like you.
Yes.
And so they were like crazy kind of story conscious, mm-hmm. about where if something were to, something happens in a script and, you know, they would be the first guys, mm-hmm. to say, you know, not the studio or anybody, well, wait a minute, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, the audience is not going to like me.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to dig me. They're going to hate
me. Right, right.
No one's going to hate me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so to them, this was just how Hollywood was going. It's how it always had been.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as they were concerned, how it always was going to be. But then starting in 67, the kind of youth counterculture movement happens.
Right.
And so by 69, when, mm-hmm. this movie takes place, by 69, all those pompadoured, wearing sport coats with patches on the sleeves, mm-hmm. guys, they're all gone. And who's taken their place is, for the most part, the hippie sons of famous people.
Right.
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 So it's Peter Fonda. Mm-hmm. It's the young Michael Douglas.
Right.
Arlo Guthrie starring in movies.
Yes.
Young David Carradine, very hippie-ish. All right.
Right.
You know, is starring in stuff. Robert Walker Jr. is making hippie movies. And but so all of a sudden, yeah, David Cassidy.
Mm.
You know, so the thing is, all of a sudden, as opposed to being a football playing, pompadour wearing, handsome leading man, you know, He-Man. Now the new leading men of Hollywood were skinny androgynous types.
Right.
You know, they were skinny, shaggy haired. From a distance, you couldn't quite tell if they were a girl or a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And when you actually got closer to them, damn, they were prettier than most women you saw. I mean,
yes.
Christopher Jones looked fucking gorgeous,
yes.
right, with his long hair. And but whether it be, you know, him or, like I said, Michael Douglas or Christopher Tabori, who was actually Don Siegel's son, they were the leading men,
mm-hmm.
of the time. And now if these guys were going to get a shot, they're going to probably play, like, you know, the cop busting them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Giving,
yes.
them a hard time. So they just literally just kind of found themselves outside of the industry. But not only that, so that's just their work potential, but they're even looking at an industry that they couldn't even understand.
Right.
All right. You know, it's like, I mean, if Rick, maybe from the end of the movie on,
mm-hmm.
he has a little bit more awareness,
mm-hmm.
that he'd be a little bit more open to things.
Yeah.
But like a couple years before, like if it would never happen,
mm-hmm.
but if he got offered the Joe Buck part in Midnight Cowboy. He
goes,
I'm not going to play that fucking guy.
Right, right.
That fag comes over to him and he's kind of cool with it. I'm not going to play some fag.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm
definitely.
I'm not going to play a male prostitute. What the fuck is that about?
Yeah, yeah.
No one wants to see that shit.
Right. It's yeah, know? It's definitely like, we wanted to keep wearing the white hats and going to Europe was kind of a question, like, oh, I don't know if I can do that.
Well, that was even a whole other thing, though, because that was like, that was just xenophobia. They're like,
right.
Oh, these fucking Italians, they don't know,
yeah.
what the fuck they're doing. I mean, we think TV's bad enough. That's a bunch of crap over there.
Right.
You know, now, you ask me, they're making some of the greatest movies
it's
ever
the
made.
The greatest movies, but they were, yeah, it's definitely xenophobia and this fear, yeah. of like the other, or like going and leaving Hollywood.
Yeah, it's, and I don't think it's fear of the other in their case. I think it's just disdain for,
right.
the other. I mean,
right.
it's like, what, these Dagos making spaghetti westerns? What the fuck is that? That's beyond ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then now, and now I don't agree with that.
No.
But having said that, when you actually hear how some of those movies were made, you can understand them going, what kind of wackadoo shit is this? Because,
yeah.
Burt Reynolds will talk about doing one of my favorite movies is Navajo Joe,
mm-hmm.
Directed by Serge Gabucci. And, you know, and the way they did a lot of these movies is the Italian movies, they dubbed them all later, so they were done without sound.
Mm-hmm.
So, but part of the reason they were done that way is so they could utilize actors from all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So thus, if you're an American, mm-hmm. in Italy or Almeria, Spain, doing your film, then your leading lady could be Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
The main bad guy could be Italian. The other main bad guy, the head bandito could be German.
Right.
You know, and maybe there's another American in there. And so the point being is you learned your dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
The Italian spoke Italian. The
mm-hmm.
Spaniard spoke Spanish. And the German spoke German. And you just knew when it was your time to talk.
Yes.
So it was,
yes.
this whole Tower of Babel,
yeah.
you know, style of acting. Really did they didn't see that, but there, I mean, there was even kind of a xenophobia. I even heard old time guys back when I was 17, guys like James Best, who I who was a teacher of mine in an acting school, who played Roscoe Coltrane on Dukes of Hazzard. Well, he was in a lot of, like, guested on a lot of Westerns in those days, and appeared in Westerns and stuff. I remember telling him that I that one of my favorite performances was Dean Martin in Rio Bravo.
Yes.
And his attitude was like, fucking spaghetti benders, and goddamn, they ruined that movie putting that fucking Italian in there.
Oh.
I mean, that's literally what they, we're not even talking about spaghetti Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, fucking Dean Martin, ruin Rio Bravo, putting that fucking Italian in there. Forget about Frankie Avalon dying at the fucking Alamo. You know, that was just kind of where they were coming from. But even I had a section, it's not in the script, but I kind of really worked out Rick's whole career plan.
Yeah.
And so I had one kind of movie like that he got offered.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, when I went through Rick's career that he went to, you know, post Bounty Law, it was almost always the same kind of situation, kind of older established cowboy guy with him, new cowboy guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like Glenn Ford and him.
Yeah.
And Robert Taylor and him, or George Montgomery and him. And that always bugged him. But when this contract finally ran out, I first started writing it as a book, so I have a whole chapter about this. He was actually pursued at one point by Roger Corman.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great.
Now, he doesn't appreciate that, but we appreciate that.
Yeah, we love that. I love that.
We appreciate that. So the thing is, Corman always kind of, like, saw him on his show, Bounty Law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a good eye for talent.
Right.
You know, he knew he would be good.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to kind of wait till his career starts going on a little bit more downwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sphere, so he can afford him more, and maybe some of that snot will be out of his nose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was, Corman had this smash, I believe it was in 60, it might be 67, but I think it was 66. He had this smash with the movie The Wild Angels with Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
And that was, and it was actually a big thing for Corman. It actually played at the Venice Film Festival. It kind of gave him a different level of respect.
Right.
He had never made a zeitgeist movie.
Uh-huh.
He didn't ever made a movie that, like, Time Magazine
would
write about as a phenomenon.
Yeah.
But he also knew he did something else, being the canny man he was, is like, oh shit, I didn't just make a hit movie. I created an entire genre.
Mm, mm-hmm.
I mean, there's going to be 20 of these fucking things.
Yeah.
By next year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Corman's going to be damned if he's going to let somebody else get through the door. You know, like, the next one that gets through the door is going to be the one that does really well.
Yeah.
So that's got to be fucking mine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he doesn't have enough time to write a whole new script from scratch. So what he does is he goes to his screenwriter, Charles Griffith, the guy who wrote A Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors, who wrote Wild Angels. He goes, okay, we don't have enough time to write a whole new movie from scratch, so we're just going to do a paraphrase remake.
Mm.
Just take the characters from The Wild Angels, make enough changes that it's not a direct remake, but we're just doing it over again.
Yeah.
With different characters.
Yeah.
So just change it enough, but not so much that I'm waiting for your fucking script.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did that. And so the next one out of the gate was a movie called The Devil's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
So, in my scenario, Corman offered Rick the Devil's Angels to be the leader of the gang. And actually, if that would have happened, that would have been a big thing for Rick. One of his, other than 14 Fists of McCluskey, one of his movies would have, like, done well.
Right.
All right. Not only would it have done well, I mean, did really well, frankly. He would have been the lead, you know, Rick Dalton in The Devil's Angels. So it's not him and somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole dilemma is like, well, who the fuck? These young kids don't know who the fuck I am. I'm a man out of time.
Mm-hmm.
This actually would have been a vaguely new Hollywood movie. This would have been a movie that would have actually catered to the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
It would have catered to young people. It would have catered to the youth movement as opposed to, you know, the rest of his movies that kind of catered to 1962.
Yeah.
And, well, naturally he turns it down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because, American International, that's just junk. Oh, shit, no, TV's better than that. That's that B-movie crap. Oh, my movies play at the drive-ins. Fuck that shit. And, by the way, I read this whole thing. This is just nothing but sex and violence. Who the fuck wants to see this crap? All right, so he turns it down so dismissively that Corman says, okay, fuck you. He never offers him anything again. But who does accept the part in The Devil's Angels? John Cassavetes.
Oh, wow.
And so John Cassavetes had, you know, was nominated for an Oscar for Dirty Dozen. Mm-hmm. He takes Devil's Angels, and his next movie is Rosemary's Baby.
Mm-hmm.
Like a part Rick would chew his lip off to get the John Cassavetes role in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And but he doesn't see the connection.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't see the correlation.
Right.
Because he's just too narrow-minded.
Yeah.
That was crazy long monologue about the history of Rick's career. Only because I know it so well.
No, I think that's amazing. I mean, it's really, to think about it, like, I think that maybe he probably would have gotten a part or offered something in Earthquake or like one of those like early 70s like disaster movies.
Okay, I think you're shooting a little high for him for Earthquake. He would definitely be in some of the TV, SST, The Disaster Flight, or something like that. I'm actually a big fan of those TV movies.
I like it too.
TV disaster movies. He would have definitely been in one of those.
Yes. Right? Isn't there one that's like Incident on I-5? There was like
Smash Up on Interstate 5.
Yeah.
With Robert Conrad, but a very, very young Tommy Lee Jones is in that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, there was sort of like maybe it's not Poseidon Adventure, but like that's something that like I sort of see him like at the helm of, or maybe later in the 80s he would be offered like Hotel or the voice of Charlie on Charlie's Angels.
I've got this sort of planned out. I mean, the thing is, there's a few things post what happens at the house.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That I'm not cagey about talking about the ending now.
But right.
If you haven't seen it now, fuck you.
Yeah.
All right. You know, you haven't been paid to see it now, then you deserve to have the ending ruined
exactly,
for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
But there's a few different ways his mm-hmm. career could have gone, and depending on who you kind of hitch your horse to,
yes,
all right, of who he's representing,
mm-hmm.
you know, it could be this way, it could be that way, the George Maharis way is this way, the Ty Harden way is that way, and I think this is kind of a combination of a few of them. But what could easily have happened, even if he had had a little bit more success in the 70s than maybe I'd give him credit for, what I could really see happen, because it happened to a lot of these guys, is by the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of these macho 50s, 60s television leading men, they showed up on TV shows again, but as the older cop.
Right.
All right,
right.
To the, you know, who's like the boss.
Mm-hmm.
The boss of the younger cop
mm-hmm.
that sends them out on the missions. You know, kind of the Dobie character from Starsky and Hutch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not Bernie Hamilton per se.
Yeah.
You know, but that guy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so if you look at it, okay, there was like, Earl Holliman is that kind of guy. And he mm-hmm. had that character on Policewoman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was her boss, sends her out on the missions. On Get Christy Love, Jack Kelly, who used to be on Maverick, was Christy Love's boss.
Right.
On David Cassidy had his show, David Cassidy Undercover.
Mm-hmm.
Vince Edwards, Ben Casey, was his boss.
Okay.
All right. And there was even a cop show that was kind of like a very Starsky and Hutchy kind of show called Bad Cats.
Uh-huh.
B-A-D Cats.
Mm-hmm.
And they got into car chases all the time. And like Vic Morrow,
was
their boss. Everything. Mm-hmm. So I could definitely see.
Yeah.
You know, Rick Dalton in like 78.
Yeah.
You know, being one of those
like
guys.
Like bossing Randolph Mantooth around.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Or Martin Milner.
Yeah.
That's him, right?
Yeah. Well, Martin Milner is more his generation.
I guess so.
So it would be like, you know, it would be guys in their late 20s.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see. That's great. I mean,
young Don Johnson.
Yeah. Like when you watch him, it's sort of also the end of like Western TV shows in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah,
because
uh-huh.
that sort of, that genre really kind of went away after, what is it, like?
Well, no, there's actually, no, it's interesting that you're even pointing that out, because the show that we have him on, Lancer, which is a mm-hmm. real show,
mm-hmm.
and it came out in 68, I fudged it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that was actually a fairly progressive show
mm-hmm.
for its time, but that is absolutely, definitively, like the last show that still fits into that 60s era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a little bit more progressive than like, say, Bonanza or something like that. It's
right.
a little closer to High Chaparral,
mm-hmm.
where it's a little bit more violent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the character of Johnny Madrid is a little more dubious.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of play that up a little bit, and had a lot of really cool guest stars, like Bruce Dern, all right? He was in my movie, like did two Lancers.
Yeah.
But by 1970, it was different. Like, so you actually had two two big Western TV shows that were phenomena hits in the 70s, but they don't have an umbilical cord to the 60s stuff. Mm-hmm. They actually have a fresher, newer sense.
Yeah.
And that was Alias Smith and Jones and Kung Fu.
Okay, yes, that's true. Yes.
And they were zeitgeist shows.
Right, right. They were definitely
different.
I mean,
there's this famous story of Elvis being late on stage for a Saturday night concert because he started watching an episode of Kung Fu in his dressing room and he had to see how it ended.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
It was on Saturday night. So it's like it's Saturday night. They're waiting 20 extra minutes for Elvis to come on stage.
Right, right. That's amazing. That's incredible. I was like, forget that Kung Fu is a Western show. Like, for some reason, I mean, maybe because it's really, it is kind of a martial arts show, too. So that seems it's more like a chop sock, like, sake
thing. It definitely fits in that and is that. And for all intents and purposes, you know, created the popularity of that for America.
Right, right.
You know, we were late to the game. Yes. Right, you know, but as far as like the America phenomena of it, it was that show that really bursted it open. And then particularly even the, as popular as the show was that original TV movie that really became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You forget about it until you actually watch the show. No, it's a Western show with all these like cool West, William Smith and all these cool Western guys you've seen show up on all these shows.
Yes, yes. Did David Carradine have a sense of that Kane? Was he still kind of Kane when you worked with him?
Well, it was interesting because had a weird situation where it was like when I was writing Kill Bill, I indoctrinated myself in so much like martial art movies and especially Hong Kong martial art movies and Japanese samurai movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Like to such a degree for like a long period, like 6 or 7 months, that it was like they were the only movies ever made.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so nothing else really existed. Like movies were kung fu movies.
Right?
And but I kind of wanted to get that tunnel vision frame of reference. You know, and that kind of weird, wonderful kind of almost when you watch the Hong Kong Shaw Brothers movies and you see them dubbed in English, that weird kind of almost Elizabethan dialogue
that they've
adopted to pull it off into English, which I actually think is actually quite beautiful.
It's
terrific. And there is an aspect where it's like now it's easy to see all the Shaw Brothers stuff in the original Cantonese, and that's great. But if you also grew up with the American dubs, you love those equally as well.
Absolutely.
All right, and you
love
that. You love that. Well, no, that I like that guy's voice.
Yeah, it's fun.
You know, he does all five of those voices. And I love him, and they all have that kind of Kiwi accent because I think they did them all in high up on top of White Lotus Mountain, since the lead of the White Lotus Clan, Pai Mei, who some fear as a devil and some worship as a god. Neither were wrong. But that was that's a weird kind of Kiwi accents that they all had.
Yeah.
If you want to fight, you fight me.
Yeah.
But one of the things is in watching the TV show Kung Fu and kind of learning, reading about it, I actually ended up having this weird thing where, and I asked David about this and he explained it to me about how it worked. For American television to try to do a show that, you know, to one degree or another deals with Buddhism, and to actually get it as right as they do in the flashback scenes, you know, to the temple, that's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, yeah.
So many of the parables that Cain, brings up, or Cain uses, or it's like, you know, you see him in the world, and then he watches a situation happen, and then then reminds him of being in the Shaolin Temple, where they taught him a parable about how to deal with, you know, the frailty of humanity. And you know, you don't have to react to it, but just know it for what it is. Observe it. And so he sees some cowboy being mean to another cowboy, and then he remembers, you know, the parable of the grasshopper and
or running
the dragonfly
across the rice paper. Didn't he have to run across rice paper?
Oh yeah, that was once he achieved his.
That was like
cheat.
So all of those things that he had to do to like just get to that place was like really difficult.
Well, I asked him. I go, because I really, really think those temple scenes are really fantastic. And then you have an actor like Ki Luke who plays the blind master Po.
He's
one of the great actors of Hollywood.
Yeah.
So I asked him about where these, you know, I mean, the parables just really worked. I started collecting them a little bit and I was like, damn, this actually really works. Mm-hmm. And he said, it was interesting. He goes, they're not Shaolin Temple. They're not Shaolin Temple teachings. He goes, mostly they're Confucianism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he goes, like, we took a little bit from American Indians. We took a little bit from, we took about for whatever worked.
Yeah.
All right. But if you slice it all up, mostly 80% of what Cain teaches, or what they teach young Cain, mm-hmm. is Confucianism.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, so well, who did those? He goes, well, that was the thing. So we had our own writers, and only our writers were allowed to write the temple sequences, the temple sequence flashbacks.
Yeah,
they were the only ones who really knew what they're doing. Now, we would accept scripts from outside people who just wanted to, you know, who were famous, well-known episodic television writers that pitched us a good idea for a Cain story. And they all wanted to write the Shaolin Temple scenes. Mm-hmm. And they all wrote the Shaolin Temple scenes. And we always threw them out. Uh-huh. Only our guys could actually do the Shaolin Temple scenes.
Yeah, yeah. That's so great.
But a weird, interesting thing about that, though, is it, you know, it kind of started affecting me a little bit, where it's like, the whole Shaolin monk thing or Buddhist monk thing of, you know, when you put on your sandals, mm-hmm. you know, you make a small prayer for the ants that you will tread upon and kill, you know, and like, you know, and they are martyrs. They don't you didn't mean to do it, but you do it nevertheless.
Yes.
That kind of philosophy started kind of getting to me a little bit. And I noticed that I have a lot of bees on my property. Mm-hmm. It's just like bees have just made beehives everywhere you can kind of make a beehive. And gardeners have come, we'll get rid of these beehives. No, they're fine. They're not hurting anybody. They're just great. Leave them alone. And so I have a lot of bees, and literally so there's beehives on the hill, but like I've got a big wall that separates my property from a couple other properties, and the bees have actually, you know, made a home inside of the wall. I mean, if I were to go to the wall with a sledgehammer, I'm sure I'd get a shitload of honey. But I kind of like the fact that, like, the bees like the place, and they like me, and I'm happy with them, and there's pretty flowers, and it's just all really nice. Anyway, I started noticing, because I keep my pool hot, I started noticing that bees would, like, land on the pool, and they would, you know, they'd die. Because it's like, I guess for a bee, it's just like, you know, the heat of the pool and the wetness of the pool is just, is intoxicating to them.
Yes.
I mean, it's so intoxicating, even though they know they could die, they cannot stop themselves.
Right.
So, like, their idea is to kind of hover above the pool, and what they're trying to do is dip their body in it just enough to feel the wetness. Now, if they do it just a little bit too much, then their wings get stuck in the water, and that's when they die.
Uh-huh.
So I started, like, you know, you go up, get up. Either I'm in my pool or I'm walking around the pool, and I see the bee, bzzz, you know, stuck in the water, just kind of doing his little lily pad thing, and, you know, he's a goner. And so then I started saving them, literally, again, thinking about this Cain-ish philosophy.
Yeah.
All right. And I started saving them. At first, I was really careful. I was like, make a big puddle in my hand and catch them and throw them over the side. Or I'd pick a branch or a leaf or some big ass leaf or something and get them on that, flip them over. Then after a point in time, I just wasn't scared of them.
Yeah.
And I just started picking them up with my hand.
Oh.
And I would just, I'd just pick them up with my hand, and they would just kind of walk around on my finger and everything. And if it was like too long, I'd flick them off because I was bored with it.
Yeah.
All right. They didn't hurt them. I saved them. All right. But okay, enough of this. But sometimes the parts that was always coolest was then they're just kind of walking all over my finger and walking all over the hand. And then all of a sudden, then their wings kind of dry up enough that they can leave. And then like I'm Cinderella, you know?
Oh,
and then you have Cinderella just puts her hand out, and like the birds are on it, you know? And all of a sudden, boom, he just flies away.
Oh, that's beautiful.
his wings got dry, and he flew away. Okay, bye-bye, Quentin. and he flew away. And then I even got to thinking, well, it's not impossible that these bees would even know who I am at a certain point. I mean, they're all going back to the same hive.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sure they're probably telling some story.
I'm sure they told somebody.
About the big guy who's actually down with them.
Yeah, that's great.
And apparently bees even, like, have a situation where they, like, you know, they know what's a threat to the hive.
Uh-huh.
And they know what's not a threat to the hive. And so they don't see me as a threat. And so they've actually prospered. But the kind of the whole concept of the, you know, praying for the ant that you're going to step on.
Mm-hmm.
That I kind of took from, you know, this aspect of it all was just the idea that if you're going to be put into a situation where you're God, mm-hmm. I can decide if something lives or dies, then you owe it to the world to try to be a benevolent God.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful.
Now, I don't feel that way about mosquitoes, but
well, mosquitoes are bloodsuckers. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's
but,
just horrible.
But I try to put that, even when it comes to flies, I try to put that forth to other to the other
beautiful.
Insect community.
I think it's really good.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What I think is like so beautiful about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is that you're paying attention to the people around Rick Dalton, which is, of course, Brad Pitt, who to me is very every flower has a gardener.
Yeah.
You know, so every star has that person. And that's I've never seen a movie relationship in
not
that
like it is in this movie, but
context.
It's one of those things
I mean,
where it's like
I,
since I've
this.
Done it, you know, I'd be like, oh man, I work with Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges has that guy.
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
been with Jeff Bridges since Rancho Deluxe.
Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah, everybody. Chris Christopher, he has that guy.
Yeah. You know? John Travolta has a few of those guys that
yeah,
look
yeah.
just like him. They're always his stand-in.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
They're always or stunt double.
Mm-hmm.
But or were one at some
yeah, yeah,
point,
yeah. Uh-huh. And then became assistants or something like
yeah.
that. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Kurt Russell had a guy like that too.
Yeah,
and it was, you know, it was a situation where I first came up with that aspect of it was I was on a movie, and I was working with an actor of that ilk,
mm-hmm.
and I was directing the film, and the actor comes to me. And he goes, look, I haven't bothered you about this because there's really nothing, you know, for him to do on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is that one punch scene where the uh-huh. guy gets punched and knocked on the ground.
Yeah.
So I have a guy.
Uh-huh.
And he's been with me for a long time. And like I said, I haven't bugged you about it because it's not really anything for him. But he could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
He could do that. So if you wouldn't mind, would you mind flying him in so mm-hmm. I could just kind of give him a little bit of, you know, give
yeah.
him a couple days work,
mm-hmm.
you know? Go, yeah, sure, go ahead. You know, and so the guy showed up and it was you could tell it was one of those things where it was probably going to be only maybe this and maybe one other movie.
Mm-hmm.
The actor would get away mm-hmm. with being able to use the stunt guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd both gotten older. Mm-hmm. You know, the stunt guy really didn't look like him that much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They'd kind of grown out in a lot. He wasn't fat, but he was just become an older guy.
Yeah.
But you could tell that there was a time that they could have practically shot close-ups of the stunt guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and it would have just fit, like, you know, just fit in step. So we hire the guy, and he's fine. He does his whole thing. And it's funny because I always talk to stunt guys like they're actors.
Yeah.
You know, so in that vein,
mm-hmm.
he does his big fall on the concrete. And it was one of those things where it was like, he's supposed to get kicked and he falls on the concrete. We keep trying to avoid actually hitting him, but mm-hmm. the angle is such that you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
And then finally, like the guy says, look, just kick me in the face. I can't fall on this concrete any longer. That's uh-huh. what's killing me.
Yeah.
So just kick me in the face and get it over with.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. So we did that. Anyway, we did it and it looked really good and felt good on the day. And so I go to him. I go, so were you happy with that?
Mm-hmm.
He goes, yeah. Yeah, of course I was happy with it. Yeah, so you feel good about it?
Mm-hmm.
Again, just talking to him like he's an actor.
Yeah.
He goes, and he refers to the actor. He goes, well, if he's happy, I'm happy.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, and it was funny because like, oh, he's not really working for me.
Yeah, yeah.
He's working for the other guy.
Right.
No, nothing wrong with that,
mm-hmm.
but that was an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, just even him being on the set, I don't talk to him that much, but I see him sitting in a director chair talking to the actor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both dressed in the identical costumes.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I actually wish I had in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's like some moment with them on one of their sets where they're both right. dressed in identical costumes.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and with Cliff wearing his Rick wig, mm-hmm. you know, as they shoot the shit. But I'm sitting there watching them dress in their identical costumes, sitting in director's chairs, shooting the shit all day, mm-hmm. like they've done for 12 years.
Yeah.
If not more.
Yeah.
And watching that, like from across the set, just that tableau,
mm-hmm.
I was like, huh, I've never done a movie about Hollywood, but if I ever do, that could be a really interesting relationship.
Right.
That could be a very interesting way in.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's like he absorbs all of Rick's like anxiety and he can calm him. He gets him to the set. Like there's always like a drive. One person's going to drive.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of softness that's around it. And then, you know, it's almost like a tiny kingdom, you know, with like one king and one servant, you know, one person in the land. So it's really, I mean, it's really interesting, but it's also really like, it's familiar.
Yeah, but, well, there's also this aspect of it when you're dealing with the, you know, with the three principals, Rick, Sharon, and Cliff,
mm-hmm.
is they all represent three different social stratas.
Yes.
Inside of Hollywood. You know, Sharon is a huge time comer.
Yeah.
You know, she's on the lip of great success and mm-hmm. and literally living the high life
right.
of 1969 Hollywood.
Yeah.
And she has the house to show for it. She has the nightlife to show for it.
Yeah.
She has the close circle of friends to show for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, it's not just, you know, Clark Gable, Lana Turner time. That kind of zeitgeist of Hollywood means that you're also best friends with the rock stars.
Right.
And you're best friends with the famous authors.
Yeah.
You know, so she's hanging out with Joan Didion mm-hmm. And probably Jasper Johns.
And pursued by Steve McQueen.
Yeah, and pursued by Steve McQueen.
Very good.
Really
yeah.
great friends with yeah. Michelle and John Phillips.
Yeah.
And, you know, Joni Mitchell. I mean, mm-hmm. like, yeah, it's everybody.
It's the best, yeah.
Here comes everybody.
It's counterculture and regular culture and high culture.
Yeah,
it's everything.
It's culture.
Yeah. I enjoyed really what I loved was just that moment of her in the theater watching herself and thinking that is just such a beautiful thing of like how innocent and exciting that is to just yeah. go by yourself to a movie theater and right. be recognized. And I really appreciated that for her.
Well, that's one of my favorite parts of the whole movie, because the whole idea with Sharon was, I mean, it's the whole idea of the whole movie. There's not really a story
mm-hmm.
in the movie. I worked on the idea of the characters for a long, long time. And at one point or another, I had more of a melodramatic story.
Yeah.
That I could have made a Rick and Cliff walk to.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of more of like an Elmer Leonard-y mm-hmm. kind of thing. And they almost seem like Elmer Leonard characters
yeah,
anyway
yeah.
to some
yeah.
degree. Yeah. So you can imagine them mm-hmm. in some, you know... You know, some you know, nefarious predicament
yes.
that they get themselves in and they have to get themselves out of. But then after I kind of really nailed the characters, I asked myself a really interesting question. I had to ask myself a really interesting question. And that was, okay, well, now that you know who these guys are, what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of story do you want to tell?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just what I can do.
Yeah.
What do I want to do?
Yeah.
And I thought about it and I thought, huh, I think these characters are strong enough. I think both the characters are strong enough and the milieu that mm-hmm. I'm creating, the world that I'm creating is strong enough that I don't think I even need a story.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can just go a day in the life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it doesn't have to take place over 6 or 7 days in order to mm-hmm. get a story going. It can literally just take place in 2 days.
Yeah.
And then we can literally cut to a third day later.
Mm-hmm.
But just it can just take place in these 2 days. And then in both dealing with Sharon and Rick and Cliff, it's just whatever happens to them
mm-hmm.
in those 2 days. Now, the encounters that they have, I think, will build up a meaning.
Yes, yeah.
And I do have the murders looming on the horizon.
Yes, yes.
So it's a ghoulish story motor.
Right, right.
But it's a story motor nevertheless.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
You always know it's always
there. It's coming.
There.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's always there. And, you know, and every scene gets you, you know, whether you want to or not, gets you a little closer to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But with that in mind, then it was a situation, well, like, I'm not going to make it that Sharon is hanging out with Rick and hanging out with Cliff. Mm-hmm. They got to get to know each other later.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
of course.
The,
of course.
That's where that's the other shoe mm-hmm. that drops. I mean, you know, he doesn't know her. I mean, that would be the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
to actually be friends with your next door neighbor. But, you mm-hmm. know, in Hollywood, you can live next door to somebody 7 years.
Yeah.
And you haven't met anybody on your block.
Right.
Unless you just happen to.
Yeah.
Unless you're mad at them.
Yeah.
And like, oh, they're building some fucking shit.
Yeah.
For 9 months, I have to put up with that crap. So when it came to dealing with Sharon, I thought what would be interesting was rather than, again, come up with some plot and now she has to talk to other characters and move that plot along,
mm-hmm.
was showing her living her life.
Yeah.
Just in these two random days.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big day in her life, not like the premiere of Rosemary's Baby,
right.
or she's shooting the Valley of the Dolls,
mm-hmm.
nothing like that, but just a couple of random days in her life. And the idea, you know, running errands and stuff. And the idea kind of being is I'm showing what was robbed from her.
Mm-hmm.
It was that was stolen.
Yeah.
It was that was taken violently mm-hmm. from her.
Yeah.
And so I thought there was a nice tribute to her.
It is.
To
it
just
is.
Kind of show her living that life that she didn't get to live. And but then in writing it, hoping that there would be one incident
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't break the idea of her just running errands.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. But would have a more meaningful feeling to it.
Right.
And the idea of her going to see the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
All right. Just having a little private moment for herself. I thought,
yeah.
accomplish that.
And it's beautiful. And it's indulging in that kind of like self-discovery and that moment of like, this is really happening, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's really magical.
Also working hard on it and then actually seeing the cause
yeah.
and effect.
It's really
cool.
You
know, because it's a silly, stupid movie that she's watching, yeah. all right? But actually, she's very good in it. It's like mm-hmm. she is the movie. She
yeah.
is she has a very funny comic thing. And I can even imagine her like really practicing that first pratfall,
uh-huh.
you know,
uh-huh.
that she does. Mm-hmm. And she's working with like Dean Martin, who's, you know, acted opposite Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
And she kind of has the Jerry Lewis role.
It's, yeah.
She's the one that's got to, is the one that's, that acts like an idiot. And she's
mm-hmm.
the one that's the clumsy one.
Yeah.
And she pulls it off to a fairly well, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned. And so the idea of actually watching that and actually having the audience applaud and
mm-hmm.
and then the idea of her practicing with Bruce Lee and then she actually does the fight with Nancy Kwan,
yeah.
you know, and the audience actually responds to it.
It's so great. Mm-hmm. It's so great. And it looks so beautiful too. Like all of the, I was actually, when I was driving through Hollywood while you were shooting, I saw like the Pussycat Theater, everything yeah, yeah, yeah. that was, and it really looked like wild in the streets.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah.
And like this is actually like, this, it's coming to life, wild mm-hmm. in the streets. The colors.
Yeah, yeah.
And the tones of like just of the different shapes and the costumes and the people.
It was interesting when we went to, okay, what streets were we going to redo? What
mm-hmm.
streets were we going to make over? And it was one of those things where it's like, it has to have enough big landmarks
right.
that were there then
mm-hmm.
to make it worth the while.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And it can't have anything too horribly big and new
mm-hmm.
that's just fucks up the entire thing.
Yeah.
At least, I mean, it doesn't mean that the street can never be touched, but we have to be able to either camouflage it,
yeah.
either turn it into something else or put something else in the way that you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put a bus there and you don't see the Apollo Loco.
Mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, or we can add some things that weren't there but are
yeah.
Period appropriate, like maybe a Pioneer Chicken sign
oh, yeah,
or something
yeah, yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And then there's enough little things that who knows what was there then and who cares what's there now.
Yeah.
We can turn it into a head shop. We
right.
can turn it into a little record store.
Yeah, yeah.
We can turn it into stuff like that. So like, you know, really the big areas that we could do that with, and I had one shot that I ended up having to take out, but it kills me because we did such a good job. But the two big areas that we were truly, truly able to do that with was Hollywood Boulevard
mm-hmm.
because those theater marquees, even though they're not
right.
theaters anymore,
yeah.
they've kept the marquees. And we
yeah.
it was and we didn't play fast and loose. We literally, what was playing, and it was February 8th, I guess it is. You know, February 8th, 1969,
mm-hmm.
what was at the Vogue
yeah.
was the night they raided Minsky's.
Yeah.
So we put that up there.
That's great. That's so great.
You know? And then all the billboards for the movies and the billboards for and the bus stops and everything were all
mm-hmm.
stuff that was either local television at that time,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Los Angeles, or they were the movies that were coming out. Candy was coming out.
Yeah.
Boston Strangler was
yeah.
coming out. But the other street, and we, I wasn't able to use the shot that like shows it off, but Riverside Drive, the whole that whole Foreman area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We had an old FBI episode, and FBI, because they were based out of Burbank Studio, shot all over the valley if they could. So if you want, what North Hollywood looked like, or Toluca Lake looked like in 1969, just watch a couple big I'm saying Big Valley, I'm in FBI.
Yeah.
Yeah. You watch FBI episodes.
I love it.
And so there was this one that, again, it was one of those things where it's like, oh shit, enough is still here from then. Okay, the furniture store is now a brokerage firm, but the and it's painted differently, but the architecture is exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so if we just paint it back to the furniture store, we're in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then like, you know, and the Foreman bar was there, and then, you know, and so we just kind of changed stuff around, and it looked great.
All of it was good. I mean, I loved the Spahn Ranch too. And you always think that, I always thought that Bruce Dern would be on Spahn Ranch anyway. Like, yeah, I think that's George Spahn. Yeah. Like, in my mind, that's who it is. So he's perfect.
If you have an idea of Bruce.
It's like, I always wish he's lying in a bed. Like, I always hope that if I ever do a scene with Bruce Dern, he's lying in bed.
Well, I think one of the reasons, like, Bruce likes to work with me now, well, we have a good time. Also, he's like, he's always quizzing me. Mm. All right. Whenever we work together, you know, because he's testing my knowledge. And so like when you know, he'll come up with an actor or an actress from that period and he'll just throw it out to me. And it's my job to come up with three movies they did. Boom, 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 boom.
Wow.
Like right there. Not come back later.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You know, Catherine Spock. Okay. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, Downhill Racer.
That's fast. Yeah. That's fast.
And so he's always doing that. But the other reason, aside from the fact that he likes my dialogue, is for the last the three times I've worked with him is, yeah, he doesn't walk.
Yeah.
He doesn't move.
Yeah.
All right. You know, he's in his little wheelchair in Django. So he just is wheeled around. He doesn't have to walk.
It's perfect.
All right. He's in that chair through all of Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
He's the only person in Hateful Eight never gets out of the chair.
Yeah.
Until he gets shot.
Yeah.
You know, and he's just never gets out of the bed.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. It's like the perfect setting for him. But in Spahn Ranch, just like laying in the bed. And I loved Spahn Ranch, and I love all of the people, the Manson family, Manson himself. Very good. Yeah. All of them. And I love
I couldn't be happier with how all of them worked out, and especially the kids at Spahn Ranch.
They're so great.
They were terrific. It was actually kind of it was interesting because they were actually really, really incredible. For one of the things about them was just even them being young people. I don't know if this is this way for Chicago actors. I don't know if this is a way for New York actors, but you know, going back to that time, young Hollywood actors oftentimes, depending how young you are, have this romanticism about the Manson family.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And just the whole romanticism of Hollywood at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of the zeitgeist and the dark subculture of it all.
Right.
Because it's just very Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And so I cast them. I almost didn't have to direct them at all. They did all their own research.
Yeah.
And I encouraged that in the auditions. For instance, like I wasn't able to give out scenes for a lot of the scenes that they would do.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of scenes I could give out. I could give out the squeaky scenes and I could give out the pussycat scenes.
Yes.
And so I would have, when it came to the gals, I would have them come. And I would have them either read one or the other scenes. So literally, I saw every young actress in town and read the Pussycat scenes. No, not even just for Pussycat, to find which other role they could play.
Right, right.
Like, oh, okay, no, she's more of a Sadie. Oh, no, she's more of a Katie. She's kind of more of a Snake. So from how they did those parts, all right, so then I'd bring them back for a callback. And then in the callback, they'd do it again. But then I said, okay, so... Now I want you to do a monologue of whichever Manson character you want. You want to do the monologue of. So you just need to come here and talk to me.
Yeah.
As that
character.
Oh,
that's cool. That's really cool.
You know, and some of them wrote poems. Some of them wrote about the first time they met Charlie. Some of them wrote correspondence that they did with Charlie.
Oh, that's amazing.
Mikey Madsen, who played Sadie, played Susan Atkins, did this like wild painting. mm-hmm. you know, for me, that it was very Basquiat, and it's like, it's all for Charlie. She has a whole poem for Charlie at the end. She cuts off a lock of her hair and stapled it to the painting.
That's great.
You know, and when the whole movie was over, I go, look, I'm keeping that painting. So, yeah. Well, it was for you. Yeah. All right, I'm saying it's for Charlie. It's for you.
That's great.
But the thing is, though, but they figured out all their relationships. Mm-hmm. If they didn't have a Manson nickname, I gave them a Manson nickname.
Yeah.
So they all had their nicknames and everything. And so once I was actually at the Spahn Ranch, mm-hmm. we just had all the Manson kids there. Because we didn't know how long it was going to take us. We figured about 2 weeks or so.
Yeah.
But I kind of needed them all there in case mm-hmm. like weird weather things happen and I have to jump around.
Yeah.
I want to shoot it in order.
Yeah.
So things can just build mm-hmm. as they build. But because of that, they were just always there. So they just were always in character. They made the Spahn Ranch their own. All that weird homeopathic where they whirl and dance around and hug each other and all that shit. They just did that all themselves.
Yeah.
They did that all the time. And, you mm-hmm. know, like when you even see like the way Lena Dunham and Margaret Qualley are in the movie, the way they're just touching each other and fondling each other and stroking each other. Yeah. I didn't tell them to do that.
Yeah.
But if you've watched the Manson movies, that is how
that's what they were doing.
That's what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And they knew to do that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was like the most prepared group of young actors that had really gotten in touch with their characters I'd ever seen. So I felt like it was like the first time as a director, I felt like I was like their volleyball coach.
Yeah. It was a really great team effort.
I felt like I was their coach, and then they were this magnificent team.
They were great.
And then we would just go and just fucking kill it at this auditorium or this gymnasium or that gymnasium. And I was just so proud of them, like a great coach.
Yeah.
And I was hoping that this would be a wonderful life experience for them that they take on.
Yeah.
And think about it for the rest of your lives.
I love it. Well, we've had a great experience here. I'm so glad that we got to talk. I haven't seen you.
You didn't talk enough, though, all right?
I felt like I just, you
winded me up and gave me subjects that were right up my alley, and so thus I just demonstratized everything.
No, but we can talk about these movies. I mean, this movie, all of your movies and movies in general forever, mm-hmm. and it's great. I mean, are you really done making movies?
Well, I still have the 10th one.
Oh, one more.
Yeah, one more.
Okay.
One more.
And then, did you start already? Or you're like...
No, no. I this is going to be my last feature film for like a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, mm-hmm. at least 4 years.
That's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was great being here.
So great.
Thanks, Margaret.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Margaret Show is an Erio's production with editing by Kat Hong and original music by Garrison Starr.
Powered by ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.